Hi, I'm Tim Grierson.
And hi, I'm Will Leach, and this is the Grierson Leach Podcast, episode 61 here at the New Republic. Yay, Grierson is back after 2 weeks. No offense to Mark Lasanti and Krista Lemire, but it is exciting to me to have my friend Grierson back. Grierson, how are you feeling? How's it feel to be back from surgery?
Yeah, well, it was crazy. It was a crazy procedure, but I mean, I feel like I'm sounding better than ever.
I gotta say, you sound fantastic. You really do.
Well, yeah, I can finally speak freely. That polyp was a real hindrance.
Apparently, I have to tell you, it must have been like 4 feet wide.
All right. Just kidding. That's not really Grierson.
Hi, I'm Tim Grierson.
And hi, I am Will Leach, and this is the Grierson Leach Podcast, episode 61, here at the New Republic. I apologize for that little false dawn with my friend Scott Duvall, who briefly played the role of Tim Grierson, because now I've got the real enchilada right here. Tim Grierson is back. How you feeling, man?
I'm feeling good, though I have to say I am feeling slightly like a Beast at the end of Beauty and the Beast, where people are like, oh, wait, that's what you sound and look like? Oh. So now I feel like I have to live up to that voice that was just before ours, which was actually kind of lovely. So I apologize. I apologize to all our listeners going forward to today's podcast and all future podcasts. But I am thrilled to be back. I've missed you. I've missed this very much. I very much enjoyed listening to Christy Lemire and Mark Lasanti these last 2 weeks, and thank them very much for filling in for me. They were great, but I'm very glad to be back, and I missed you.
Yeah, well, thank you. It was good to have you back. You are downright velvety. Listening to you talk now, I'm starting to worry I might have a polyp. You sound very good, and I sound like I smoked for 15 years. But regardless, you're back, but you're feeling good. Health-wise, the surgery could not have gone better. Everything is tip-top. I know that we're not gonna have you talk forever on this podcast. You're still a little bit of recovery, but generally speaking, everything went very well.
Yes, it turned out that I had a nodule, not a polyp. The difference is not worth sharing on this podcast, but I did have a nodule. And Will, you actually met my ear, nose, and throat doctor when we went to the Rogue One premiere, which was one of the most LA moments of my life, was introducing you to my ear, nose, and throat doctor at a big premiere in Hollywood. But he wanted to let me know because he is a big movie guy, and we talked about movies during several of my appointments with him. He agrees with us about Logan, so he wanted to make sure he passed that along to me and to us. But no, I'm feeling good. I'm just feeling like me again, which is very, very nice.
All right. Well, please now, everyone, direct your tweets to Grierson's ear, nose, and throat doctor and not at me and Grierson, because we've been getting plenty. All right. So now the way this episode is going to work, as I said, we have to keep it a little tighter for Grierson as he works his way back here. So we actually did these last two reboots. When you hear the last two reboots, by the way, don't be like, oh my God, Grierson's relapsed. The nodule has come back in the middle of the podcast. Please make him stop talking, Will. Worry not. We recorded both of these because we didn't know how long Grierson was going to be out. So we recorded both of these before he went to have a surgery. So you will get, we will truly have the Weight Watchers challenge of the before and after. You will be able to hear specifically on this podcast just what that nodule was doing and how Grierson sounds so much better now. And then we're also going to talk about the movie Life. That'll be our first movie, the main movie we'll talk about. And then we'll also be talking about two wide releases this week that I have not seen because, screw it, I just didn't want to. And Grierson had to see that are Chips and Power Rangers. But of course, we also have our reboots, so we'll begin to do those in a moment. But of course, this is the time we remind you always to please subscribe to us on iTunes, find us on SoundCloud and NewRepublic.com. Please rate and review us on iTunes. It makes it easier for people to find the podcast. And if you give us a review on iTunes, give us the name of a movie you would like us to talk about, and we will discuss it in our reboot section. We have two reboot movies this week. As aforementioned, they are before Grierson had the nodule. I'm going to make sure to just say nodule from now on. We are not a polyp place. This is a nodule place. Polyps are for losers. Nodules are for men. The first of our reboot movies this week that we taped beforehand comes to us from Josie Lee. Josie Lee, you guys rock. 5 stars. Enjoyed Ben-Hur Breaking Away discussion. This is from August, by the way. You guys rock. I like that you don't always agree on the films and offer good reasons why you agree or differ. Keep up the great work. Kudos on mastering editing the podcast, Will. Well, we'll see. Other than your choice of intro music, hey, they sound great. LOL. Can you reboot Hitchcock's The Trouble with Harry? So our first movie in our reboot section this week will be The Trouble with Harry. Our second movie comes to us from Sut83, a masterpiece, 5 stars. It's worth noting that the movie that Sut83 wants to talk about, Sut actually gave us 2 separate reviews with this movie mentioned. So Sut really wanted to hear us discuss this week's movie. A haiku, Sut83 writes, oh, Grierson Leach, how do I love thy podcast? 5 stars worth, I guess. Definitely worth a listen. That doesn't sound like a haiku. They should have closed it off when I knew that haiku was over. I guess 5 stars worth, I guess, is when the haiku ended. Anyway, great coverage of new movies. Also great banter. I will put in another vote to please review Big Business. So we've been discussing Big Business as our second reboot movie. But we're going to get right in to our first movie that we both saw this week, the big release of the weekend. It is Life.
These creatures wiped out Mars millions of years ago. If we let it get to Earth,
we'll risk all human life.
Let's kill the thing.
Life. It's literally all we have. But is it any good?
Life is directed by Daniel Espinosa. It stars Ryan Reynolds, Jake Gyllenhaal, Rebecca Ferguson, and Olga, Russian name. It is, of course, it is a movie about aliens. It's a movie specifically about aliens. There is a group of people on a spaceship where they are flying around trying to... They're basically... The movie opens with Ryan Reynolds, this kind of this hotshot astronaut guy, doing this risky mission to try to grab this particular specimen as they're floating around Mars. They grab it. They bring it in. They put their scientists on it. They're all figuring it out. This is an interesting piece of thing we've gotten from this other world. They realize, oh my gosh, it's alive. It is in fact alive. That's amazing. We've discovered life. How happy, how wonderful. Then things turn to the bad side because it turns out this alien is in fact trying to kill them. And so we are therefore have a scenario in a movie we have seen, I would say many times, where there are people trapped on a spaceship. There is an alien trying to kill them. They are trying to figure out how to either survive the alien or to avoid the alien coming down to Earth or to figure out what exactly they are fighting and dealing with. So now, this movie has been compared quite a bit to Alien and Aliens and generally many movies of this sort of ilk, some of which have been good and some of which have not been good. This movie, I will say, this has got some big name actors in it. Well, we've talked in the past about how much we like Rebecca Ferguson, who was in Mission Impossible 7, 9, 15. It was one of the best parts of that movie, of the most recent Mission Impossible movie, and how disappointed we were and how badly she was used in Girl on the Train and how badly everything in Girl on the Train was good was used. She's really good in this movie. She's a really good actress. Jake Gyllenhaal is good in this movie. Ryan Reynolds is good in this movie. Generally speaking, these are big actors. These are good, like, talented people that we all like and have a lot of respect for, which is why it was a little surprising to me to see just how derivative Life is. And I mean that not in a necessarily a bad way, but if you're looking at this movie and you're like, wow, I don't know, this feels like a movie I've seen many times before. One of the surprises for me about Life was it is in fact a movie I have seen many times before. I found myself looking for moments in this movie like, okay, well, this is the moment that elevates the material. This is what got Ryan Reynolds and Rebecca Ferguson and Jake Gyllenhaal excited about this material. There's this twist on it, or there's this sort of thing. And I will say, this is a pretty standard issue alien attacking people and people trying to survive movie. I think it's a pretty much averagely well done version of that. I think there are some good moments. There are some good things that work here or there. There are other things. This movie is competently put together and is put together in a logical fashion. Nothing that I found myself disliking. It's perfectly professional. My problem really is just that there's so little surprises for this that I think the bar for how well directed it needs to be, or how exciting it needs to be, or how thrilling it needs to be, is a little bit higher just because it doesn't throw a lot of new twists at you. And I will say that bar for me was not entirely met. This is not a bad movie. This is the ultimate movie that you catch on when life has left you behind and you are sitting alone at on a Saturday evening crying because your family has left you, and this got darker than I meant it to. But everything has fallen apart for you. This is a movie that you'll just catch on and be like, yeah, this is kind of interesting. I would put this like a little bit less interesting than, say, Event Horizon, but more interesting than, say, Alien 4. Is that where I'd put this? I was okay with this movie, but I just don't think it's exciting enough to overcome just how derivative it is.
Yeah, it's good enough. Like, that was sort of my feeling. I reviewed it for us in the New Republic, and that was really where I came down on it, which is that it is derivative, not just of Alien, like you said, but also, like, there's a little bit of 2001 in it. There's a little bit of Gravity, actually a decent amount of Gravity, I would say, especially in the opening sequence of this movie. But I have to say there were enough elements that even though you kind of know what the movie is from the get-go, that kept me engaged. And the first of those things I have to say is the alien itself, which I actually found really nice and creepy and unsettling. I think in general for me, if I have an alien or some sort of, you know, we talk about this with the Great Wall from earlier in the year. Like, you know, the strength of those types of movies is, does the thing freak you out or does it not freak you out? I have to say that the alien that they name Calvin in this movie, he freaks me out pretty sufficiently. He's creepy crawly enough. Like, he sort of looks like a starfish. He's got all these like tentacles, but as he gets bigger, he seems to have like teeth or something like that. The way that he sort of slithers around the ship, I actually found pretty effective and did kind of freak me out. I liked that there's no grander theme to either the movie or the alien. The alien is not supposed to represent, like, don't you see, like, how we don't appreciate other genders or races. I mean, it's not a movie that's trying to actually sort of hit you over the head with any sort of point. It's basically, no, it's an alien. It's on the ship. It needs to survive. It figures it has to kill all the humans so that it can thrive. And so it's just going to kill all of them. And that's really the movie. And I have to say that, you know, Daniel Espinosa, who I don't think is a great filmmaker, he previously made Safe House from about 5 years ago. He's just a guy who, like, I think of him as sort of like a modern day, like, Peter Hyams or somebody like that, where it's like, like, you just make, you know, even though he doesn't write and direct everything like Hyams did, it's kind of like you just, it's a space alien movie. Do I have, like, draw you a map? You just do it. And, and I think that he does it with enough professionalism. There's no sense of that the movie is winking at you and saying, like, hey, do you see that we're doing a riff on Alien? It's just like, no, it's like, it's a universe where the alien movies don't exist. And this is like a new thing for everybody in the film. And on that modest level, and you talked about Rebecca Ferguson, I thought she's really good in it too. I also like the fact, maybe we'll get into spoilers in a second, but I will say for right now, that just because certain people are big names in the movie, that does not mean that they're going to survive till the end. I kind of liked that. But on its own sort of like modest sort of merits, I found it gripping enough that I did enjoy the experience.
Yeah, I think part of the problem for me that held me back a little bit on this is none of these characters, not only are they not that interesting, there's not even put a lot of thought into, like, remember how much everybody made fun of Sandra Bullock's backstory in Gravity? Like that, like, I liked it, but it certainly was a little on the nose. But to hear, like, they barely bother here. like basically one person wants to stay in space, the other person wants to go home. And that is the driving influences. How convenient that it works out in that's the totality of their personalities, really, when you kind of break it down, which again speaks to, you talk about one man's modest is another man's particularly uninspired. And I think that, or not trying all that hard. And to me, that's another example of this. It would be different if yeah, sure, this is like a lot of alien movies that we've seen, or a lot of space movies that we've seen, but here's a really interesting character, or here's a really interesting twist. This movie literally has no really interesting twists or really interesting characters. I agree with you. I think the alien's kind of interesting. I like that the alien is... This is why a dialogue that puts this maybe a little bit on the nose, but one of the things I liked about the alien beforehand, the alien is not evil. The alien is just surviving. The alien is just new. Like, the alien really never attacks him until it is really threatened and starts to realize, oh, okay, at least perceives to be threatened, and therefore it sort of attacks there. The alien is not this evil thing. It's also very intelligent, but it doesn't seem to be, like, intelligent in a way where it hit the superpower button and it's just intelligent. Like, it does seem you can track its intelligence in a way that's kind of interesting. I just couldn't quite get over the top with it, of the idea of, like, of it just feels so rote in so many ways that it's, again, perfectly pleasant. I just think I've required a little bit more than perfectly pleasant.
I think we should talk about the ending, because I think a movie like this, I'm just speaking for myself, the movie kind of lives or dies on how it kind of sticks the landing. And I'd be curious to sort of talk about, how the ending worked, for you.
Okay, so then here's what we're going to do. I'm going to say spoilers. So spoilers now. If you do not want to know the end of this movie, go ahead and fast forward until you hear the trailer for Chips. Okay? So next time you hear music, so Grierson, please do not have your newfangled special voice start sounding or singing a song like that sounds like the trailer for Chips in the middle of your discussion of Life, because people will be confused.
Right, no problem. Gotcha.
Otherwise... If you do not want to be spoiled, just fast forward your little 15 seconds forward until you get to the trailer for Chips. There you go. Bing. Spoilers commencing now. Okay, so the big thing that happens at the end of this movie is it turns out that basically one character is trying to get back down to Earth to live, and another character is trying to go off into deep space. Deep space is always very scary. It's always very ominous in these movies. Trying to go off to deep space with the alien to get out. And as it turns out, the movie is shot and it's put together to where you think, oh, they made it. He survived. And the alien is now off into deep space, and the character we wanted to survive made it to Earth. And it turns out that's not what happens.
Right. I thought that ending was pretty darn good, with the caveat that I think the Espinoza, and I'm assuming I'm just talking to people who have actually seen the ending to this movie, so they know what I'm talking about. I think Espinoza holds that shot too long of the escape pod landing on whatever ocean that's supposed to be, which I'm not sure if that's supposed to be the Indian Ocean, but I think it holds on that shot as the fishermen come up too long, because I went, oh, that's what just happened. And I liked the surprise of that, but I wish that when the door is open, I still thought it was Rebecca Ferguson in the pod. I think he holds on that too long. I think that's a mistake. But I think that the execution of that, especially in relation to gravity, works pretty darn nicely. And it was enough for me, because I was waffling back and forth on what I was going to give this movie grade-wise, that I thought, you know what? I like that. And I would also just add to that, I think one of the twists that does work nicely, or that's interesting in this movie, is the idea of it's not enough for them to get away, that they do have to worry about the alien getting to Earth. And so I think that whole thing when the other like ship shows up, and it turns out they're not there to rescue them, but they're actually there to make sure that the alien is destroyed, and therefore if the other humans on board die too, that's fine. I actually think that's actually a nice little kind of wrinkle on what is a pretty familiar, let's run around the ship while the alien's kind of following around us. Again, these are not like groundbreaking, oh my God, kind of things. Both in the confines of this movie, both of those elements I thought actually worked pretty nicely.
And just the notion too, and I think it works okay. It's funny when you think back and you realize, oh, so Jake Gyllenhaal's great idea at the end to get her home is actually what may have doomed humanity. Like the idea, if they would have done what they were supposed to do or what she had actually planned for them to do and have them pushed off into space like they could have been and not use the escape pod, I currently right now would not be being eaten by this alien. But
right, yes.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, I think the Espinosa sells it enough because they've established, albeit incredibly bluntly, that John Hall's character would prefer to be in outer space, that he doesn't like being on Earth. That feels like enough of a sacrifice that you think, oh man, that's a pretty dark ending. And so I think you buy that. And then when it turns out, no, it's actually the super dark ending, I think people are, at least for me, were surprised enough and kind of pleased, frankly, that that's where they went with the movie. But anyway.
All right. So ultimately, what did you give it?
I gave it a perfectly solid B minus.
Perfectly solid B minus. I gave it a just missed C plus. Just missed. Very close, right on the edge, but just missed C plus. So that is life. Life. It's literally all we have.
By the way,
isn't any good?
By the way, since I've been gone, of course, the Andy Daly Show has returned, and so it's hard to give reviews on this show with letter grades and not feel slightly like Forrest McNeil while doing it. But
yeah, yeah, it's funny because this will be the last show. Because so if you watched all, I've been wanting to talk to you about this for a while. Actually, this is a brief thing. So sorry, everyone that didn't want their spoilers, you're missing our fun life discussion if you like this show. But have you watched the entire show start to finish?
I think I've missed a couple episodes in the middle, but I generally have the gist of what's happened and what's transpired. Yeah.
One of my favorite things that reminds me so much of our darkness, he will not give anything zero stars. He will not. Like at one point he has to review racism and he's like half a star. And AJ Gibson says, no, it's gotta be zero stars. It's racism. He's like, no, I'm sorry. I just don't give half stars. Just like Chris said, I really don't like to give Fs unless it's Warcraft.
Yeah, our version of that, I feel like, is A pluses.
Yes.
We're on the other side of the spectrum. We never give anything five stars, so yes.
Yes. If you like that show, it's the last episode. It is honestly one of my favorite shows on television in a very long time, and it makes me very happy. So see Andy Daly's review. So B minus from you on life, C plus from me, and an A plus 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 plus, even though we don't give those to Andy Daly's review. All right, so the next one I'm going to ask Chris a few questions about, because I haven't seen it, because screw that, is Chips.
California Highway Patrol think they have some crooked cops. They want you to go on the inside.
Go undercover within the department? That's awesome.
We put you with a rookie named John Baker.
So who am I playing?
Francis Llewellyn Poncherello.
Are the first two female names?
Hi, Grissom. Chips is written and directed by Dax Shepard. It stars Dax Shepard, Michael Pena, Adam Brody, Isaiah Whitlock, Eric Estrada, I'm assuming he shows up at some point, Kristen Bell, and all sorts of people. It is, of course, the movie version of the 70s TV show with Eric Estrada and the other guy. I honestly don't know who the other guy was. Regardless.
I did not do my due diligence and look this up. Yes. It was the one that Liz Lemon had the crush on in 30 Rock.
Right, yes. Of course she did. Of course she did. Okay, so Chips, this is based... Okay, so Chris, I got a few questions for you. About the movie, first off, I have to say, Dax Shepard is not a... I didn't realize he was a hyphenate, but apparently he is. This is kind of his, this is not only written and directed by him and starring him, it also has his wife, Kristen Bell. She's in this movie. Is he... Is this have the feel of a passion project? Why? Or is this a guy that wanted to do a wacky comedy and they just kind of seized on the brand name?
I think it's the latter. I mean, you know, he's written and directed one other movie called Hit and Run from a few years ago, which was not... And that movie also had his wife in it as well. They were the two main stars of it. And that movie was not very good at all. But it actually had these really great car chases in it. And so... And that's actually one of the best parts of Chips as well, as some of the chase stuff. It's actually pretty well done. But it's a weird thing because I do not remember Chips very well. I mean, I'm culturally aware of it, but I didn't like love it or watch it when I was younger. I have been led to understand that Chips aficionados hate this movie because it really is just like there's a guy named John Baker, and there's a guy named Ponch, and they are in there, like, they're part of the California Highway Patrol, and that is about the only connection it has to the TV show. Basically, it is 21 Jump Street, except the characters are stupider, and they're hornier. That's the pitch for Chip. So if this was a passion project for Dax Shepard,
weird passion.
That's a unique passion, I suppose. But yeah,
I have to say, I had been hoping, man, I like 21 Jump Street. I just wish Jonah Hill would have been hornier. That's actually what I was hoping for out of that movie. I have to say though, I don't have no particularly bad thoughts about Dax Shepard. I like Michael Pena. I like Kristen Bell, and I do like a good big dumb comedy if done well. I guess this is just a really primary question. Is this movie funny?
I think it's weird. It is funnier than I think has been advertised. It's not funny enough to recommend, but I will say I did laugh at stupid stuff. You and I, of course, being great fans of Roger Ebert, will remember his fantastic reviews for the Naked Gun movies, where he talked about that you laugh and then you laugh at yourself for laughing at what you laughed at. Chips has certain elements. I mean, this movie is, I mean, it's most passionate critics who have called it, you know, homophobic and sexist and like that. They're not too far off. My mild defense is I think the movie is actually a little more self, kind of like knowing in that humor than I think it's being given credit for. But it's still a very stupid comedy where, you know, the two main like male characters hug and they're both wearing just underwear and they worry that if they touch penises, that means that they're like gay and they freak out about that. I mean, that's the level of humor in this movie. They're both bad at their jobs and so they do dumb things while being policemen. This is really not a sophisticated comedy and it's really, really hit or miss. I laughed a few times though. Probably, again, more than I would probably be proud to admit under oath, but yes, I did laugh on occasion at this movie because I think Shepard can be funny. I think Michael Pena is really funny and can be really funny. So it's not a disaster, I guess.
Right, not a disaster. I'll take that. I guess the last thing I put on this, because it's funny, Angie Tribeca, you and I have discussed Angie Tribeca before.
Yes.
I'm a big fan of that show. And to me, the great appeal of Angie Tribeca, like The Naked Gun, even though I think it twisted the formula a little bit in the second season, it is another one of those shows where I just can't believe I'm laughing at how stupid it is. Though I find it, like, third season just started, and I can't wait to watch it. I've not chance of watching it, but I saw previews for Angie Tribeca during the NCAA tournament. And I was like, man, I miss this show. I want to watch this show. Like, I have very good feelings to that show, even though while I'm watching it, I'm often like, okay, come on. I can't believe I'm still hanging with this. Is this funnier than Angie Tribeca? Is it equally funny than Tribeca, or is it less funny than Angie Tribeca?
It's less funny than Angie Tribeca. That first season, I will go to the mat for. I think it's actually one of the incredibly perfectly done seasons of comedy. I had more issues with the second season because I feel like it went away, like you kind of mentioned. From what I think the real kind of like Zucker Abrams Zuckerness of the whole thing. The problem among many with Chips is that it's not really even like the way the 21 Jump Street movies were, where they were, you know, parodies of the buddy cop movie. Chips is just kind of like a dumb version of the buddy cop movie. It's not really riffing on anything, and so it doesn't have anything it's falling back on. So the entire movie is moment to moment, am I laughing at something dumb? As opposed to, it's part of a larger thing, which I think Angie Tribeca, even when it, like a joke bombed, you got the concept of it so beautifully that you were just sort of locked in. So no, I also saw all those commercials for Angie Tribeca and like could not wait. I mean, just that cast, I mean, the fact that I have Chris Pine and all those people, I'm so excited. No, Chips is not to that level.
All right. So ultimately, first off, I'm still kind of reeling for the fact that there are Chips aficionados out there still. talk about, I'm all for steadfast devotion to the source material. But the idea that, like, that is not what Punch would do in that situation makes me actually a little sad, to be entirely honest with you. But who am I? Who am I to say?
Everybody's got their something, I suppose.
To be fair, I still have, like, not, I still listen to some Meatloaf albums that aren't even of the Bad Out of Hell trilogy, so I don't get to say anything.
Yes, you really, you still do. Really, I can't believe that.
I know.
Boy.
I don't know anything about you, baby, but okay, you're everything I'm dreaming
no,
of.
I believe.
I don't know who you are, but I'm a real dead ringer for love.
Two quick things. Number one, I believed you. You didn't have to sing to prove it. Number two, just because I still am under doctor's orders not to sing, you don't have to flaunt your singing, your beautiful singing ability, Will.
That's the song he did with Cher. It's pretty good. It's also a Jim Steinman original. Another interesting thing about that album is, you know, I should probably move on.
I'm imagining someone fast-forwarding through the spoiler alerts, now hearing this and going, wait, are they still talking about life? No.
In
a grander sense, we are. In a grander sense, exactly. We're talking about life. Yes.
Okay, what'd you give Chips?
I gave it a C+. I actually think the supporting cast, including Rosa Salazar and also Kristen Bell, I think are actually pretty funny in the movie. I think Kristen Bell plays his like super bitchy ex-wife, and I think that she kind of leans into that performance in a pretty fun way. It's stupid. I am ashamed of myself for liking it even as much as I did, but it's a C+.
All right. Well, and just to mention of Kristen Bell, this is a reminder to everyone to go watch The Good Place. The Good Place is a very good show. But that's now three television shows that we have recommended in this movie podcast. Let's get back on track.
Yeah.
All right. So that was Chips. So our final movie I'm going to ask Grierson about is Power Rangers.
You know, something happened up there, okay? I'm not the same.
I'm strong.
How strong?
I can say really strong.
No. I feel like we need to go back out there.
I'm gonna jump across with her and then you jump.
Piece of cake.
Let's go.
No, don't jump. Jason! That's not a piece of cake!
I tried to say Power Rangers there the way they might say it in the advertisement for the toys. You guys got that.
Did you watch the TV show real fast? You didn't watch it, right?
No, I literally have zero. Not only emotional connection, intellectual connection, zilch, nada, none, bupkis, nothing. Yes. I know nothing about the Power Rangers.
Yeah, because as a quick side thing, two critics who were slightly, but not that much older than me, both said to me, like, well, this didn't mean much to me, but I'm sure, like, you really like the TV show. I'm like, we're not that much different age, dude. Like, to me, Power Rangers was like... this would be like if they took one of those like MTV characters, like that guy, like Randy of the Redwoods, and turned it into a movie. That's how much like cultural knowledge I have of Power Rangers. Like it was a thing and I remember it existing, but I have no, I had to do so much research, before seeing this movie so I would know what the hell was going on.
All right, so this is directed by Dean Israelite, who did Project Almanac. And so, you know, if you're a completist, here's that. This is based off, I think this is also Saban. I guess Saban is the toy company. Saban, whatever. It's Saban's Power Rangers. Saban's Power Rangers. I'm assuming it's just Nick Saban, coach of the Alabama Crimson Tide, decided to make a movie. Apparently, it's the third film of the Power Rangers film franchise. That's news to me as well. It is about five people that are all dressed up in different colors and fight things. That's really all I can really tell you from my understanding about this, other than the fact that it has these five people. And also, Bill Hader seems to be the voice of a wisecracking robot. Bryan Cranston, I have lots of questions of Bryan Cranston, actually. We're going to get here in a moment. Elizabeth Banks is in here as well. My first question for you, Grierson, is it, in fact, Morphin time?
You know how we had the whole conversation when we saw Warcraft, and I thought to myself, is this an F? Is this not an F? I'm just going to put my cards on the table. I hated this movie. I am stunned how many people kind of like went along for the ride with this movie. And I'm not even talking about like the $40 million it made this weekend. Just like colleagues and friends of mine, critics who were just like incredibly sheepish, were like, you know what? I kind of enjoyed it. And I was like, oh God. I think it's just terrible. You know, it's a movie. It's like, boy, I really wish like the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, was like even, dumber Like, this to me is what Power Rangers kind of is. My understanding is that, you know, it's somewhat faithful to the source material. And, you know, it's, you know, about these five mismatched teens in this coastal town in California. I'm gonna steal a line from our good friend Christy Lemire, since I was on the radio with her recently. She was talking about it, and she's like, basically, like, it's like the Breakfast Club, but with like superheroes. They're all at like, some of them are at like a Breakfast Club type of thing. They meet up with some other teenagers at the same high school that they don't necessarily get along with. They stumble upon these like magical coins that give them superpowers, and they go to this buried deep underground spaceship that's been buried for millennia. It's run by like the ghost of Bryan Cranston's character, who used to be a Power Ranger, and he informs these five teenagers that they are essentially the chosen ones whose job it is to protect Earth from evil invaders from outer space. And I looked at the five teenagers and thought, these can't possibly be the five people who have been chosen to protect Earth. I dislike all of these characters so much, and they're so like edgy in quotes. Like it's like, imagine like five Poochies having to protect the Earth, and that's kind of what you have. And one of the things that has come out about the movie is that, you know, this is the first kind of major superhero event movie to have an LGBTQ character. It's also one of the first to have a character who is autistic. That's played by RJ Seiler, who was in Me and Earl and the Dying Girl. And so in terms of progressiveness and diversity, that's interesting. That does not change how much I dislike the characters and just kind of how generic. We talked about this with Life, about like how it's derivative and stuff like that. And that movie is. But this movie to me is so boringly, cynically put together in terms of, let's make it like a superhero movie and let's have this trope and this trope and this trope. Even to the idea of having Elizabeth Banks, she plays a former Power Ranger who has like gone to the dark side. Her name is Rita. Her name is Rita Repulsa. And that's from the TV show. And so she really just sort of like camps it up in the movie. And even like that feels like a trope of this type of movie, where you have like the bigger star who just kind of like chews the scenery and winks at the audience for how like, can't you believe I'm being so like campy and bitchy in this movie? I think this movie absolutely is terrible. Really, really, really terrible.
Is she really bad? Is it at least fun to watch? Like, I like Elizabeth Banks. I like Bryan Cranston. Do they, like, first of all, it just seems like Bryan Cranston is, the guy has certainly shown post-Breaking Bad that he's not afraid to pick up some checks that he may have been missed over the first 40 or 45 years of his career. But certainly, as Elizabeth Banks, I've seen her clips of her. It looks like she's trying to be amusingly over the top. Is she, or does she lose her dignity, and the same with him?
I think she's fun in the movie, and she's the lone bright spot. Bryan Cranston, what's that thing where you put, it has like a bunch of like pins and you put your hand in it and there's like an impression of your hand. Like, Bryan Cranston's character, that's how you see him. If anybody's seen the trailer, or God forbid you've seen the movie, you know what I'm talking about. His face is on a wall talking to the Power Rangers. And so that's what he actually looks like the entire time, is that he looks like his face has been pushed through one of those things, which is incredibly distracting, because most of the time while he was on screen, I was trying to think of the name of that toy, because I was so so interested. Bill Hader does play the wisecracking robot who sort of like guides the Power Rangers. The idea is that these five teenagers cannot morph into the suits that we know so well. They can't morph into those until they really come together as a team. And so you have these scenes of them like, guys, come on, we've got to like come together as a team. And they try to like bond. And as they're trying to bond, they get a little closer to morphing into the suits. But the question is like, what's the missing link? Why are they not coming together as a team? You know, you joked about, you know, Nick Saban. But I fear for the coach who uses this movie as a motivational tool for his athletes, saying, you guys have got to come together the way these stupid teenagers did to get their suits and Power Rangers, and that team will revolt against their coach and not want to play anymore. So part of the movie's like whole narrative arc is, how are these guys going to come together? They're so different, and they're so opposed to each other in a lot of ways. How are they going to come together again to save Earth from being destroyed? Because they're our only hope. Did I mention I didn't like this movie? I don't like this movie.
I guess my last question, I'm not even sure I want to know the answer to this, but I feel I'm kind of curious, I guess. Is this, you know, every time you get a reboot or every time someone's trying to re-energize a franchise, you know, it's either a gritty version or you go the other direction. It's the fun version that doesn't take itself so seriously. Which one of those is this, or is it actually one of those?
It's kind of interesting that it tries to do a little bit of both. It mostly wants to be, I mean, it's grittier than the TV show just because it's not like completely goofy. Like, because, you know, cause, you know, the show was like this Japanese series that they brought to the US and just took the footage and then like dubbed over it and then shot new stuff. And that's why it just looks so goofy on the original show. This movie is not necessarily like a dark, like it's not Batman Begins exactly, but they're trying to make it a more realistic, like to give the movie credit, this is what it's trying to do. It's trying to be a like sensitive look at high schoolers and a racially diverse, you know, also in terms of sexuality and like that, these diverse people who all feel like misfits in their own way, and they come together and the coming together. I mean, it's essentially, it's like X-Men, except like a stupid version of X-Men. And so that's what it's trying to be. So it's on the darker side, I guess, as far as it goes. But there are these campy elements. Like, they do have Elizabeth Banks doing what she does. They do use the Go-Go Power Rangers song at one point in the movie. And this is the drum I keep beating for the film, or about the film. There is the longest product placement in recent movie history. There is a long thing dedicated to Krispy Kreme, and it becomes a very important plot point where the characters have to find a Krispy Kreme because there is something at the Krispy Kreme location that is very important, again, for the future of Earth at the Krispy Kreme. So it's so blatant product placement that you almost wonder, to reference 30 Rock again, like, is this supposed to be a joke about this type of product placement? But in my heart of hearts, I just don't think so.
Yeah, my science point to know on Kirsten, I gotta say. All right, Kirsten, let's put this one out of its misery. What'd you give it?
I gave it a D-.
D-. Okay, so beat Warcraft.
Congratulations, Warcraft. You still... Marine
if Elizabeth
Supreme.
Banks, if Elizabeth Banks would have shown up for like 15 minutes in Warcraft, maybe we could have got a D-.
That was actually the demarcation point for me, honestly. Yes.
All right. Well, there you go, Elizabeth Banks. Now you know to Warcraft people putting together that sequel. Call Elizabeth Banks. Do so immediately. Elizabeth Banks, do not answer. Put your phone on mute. All right. So, Grierson, now we're going to go into our reboot section. That, again, remember to remind everyone that the reboot is, we've done this reboot, I guess a month ago, I guess 3-4 weeks ago now, pre-nodule removal. So beware, now you understand what Grierson sounded like before and Grierson sounded like after. Grierson's going to pop back up with me to put a button on this episode after the two reboots. But first, our first reboot is The Trouble with Harry.
The trouble with Harry is that he's dead. And one of these real nice people could have caused that trouble. Perhaps the sweet old sea captain, who actually wasn't a very good shot. Or the New England spinster, who would go to any lengths to defend her honor.
The Trouble with Harry is directed by Alfred Hitchcock and came out in 1955. For people who are not up on their Hitchcock filmographies, this came out 3 years before Vertigo, a year before The Man Who Knew Too Much, a year after Rear Window. If you ever look at like Alfred Hitchcock's filmography, by the way, the man was so incredibly proficient, and the fact that he made so many great movies in such a short span of time is kind of incredible. This is also a massive
honor. So many different movies.
Yeah, it's so many different movies. Of course, I am not telling anybody anything they don't already know, but every once in a while you kind of look back and go, holy God, this one guy did all of these movies. The Trouble with Harry is one of those films that falls into the category of underrated gems or not nearly seen enough or underseen masterpieces. That's usually how a movie like this is described. For people who haven't seen it, it's about a corpse named Harry who is discovered by a group of people in a small community in Vermont. All of the different people who find the body are convinced or concerned that maybe they are involved in the death of this person named Harry. One of the people is a captain, Captain Wiles, played by Edmund Gwenn, who in my family is known and loved as Santa Claus from Miracle on 34th Street. In fact, it's incredibly distracting to watch him in this movie because his voice so sounds like Santa Claus. It actually adds kind of a fun twist to this movie. In her first major film role, Shirley MacLaine plays Harry's estranged wife, who wonders if people are going to suspect that she was involved with his death. Captain Wiles falls in love with this older woman named Miss Gravely, played by Mildred Natwick, who also gets involved with Harry's burial and also digging him out of the ground and burying him back into the ground. And then finally, you have Sam Marlowe, who is a artist who's kind of trying to make his way professionally, played by an incredibly young and handsome John Forsythe. Holy God, ladies, was this man good looking. I preface this by saying that this is one of those movies when you go back and sort of look at his filmography, or if you read Amazon reviews, which of course I never recommend that you do. The Trouble with Harry is one of those movies that will often be described as, well, you've seen like all like the established masterpieces of Hitchcock. You should really see this. Or Trouble with Harry doesn't get enough attention or respect. It's really kind of an underrated gem. I wouldn't go that far in terms of how I feel about The Trouble with Harry, but it's the type of film that I think gains because of the other films that Hitchcock has made, which are better, but this one is sort of a fun little like B-side, if you will, or kind of a demo or an outtake in a pretty brilliant career. I think what's great about this movie is the potential for this idea, which is a bunch of people come together because they're not sure if maybe they're involved in the death of this person, and they feel like they should do something to kind of clear their consciences. But at the same time, Harry is a character in the movie, but not really. And the movie kind of blithely sort of ignores the fact that there's a corpse, an actual dead body throughout much of the film. And I think that movie, it gains because of the fact that it's Hitchcock. Not unlike, say, a movie like The Game works really well specifically because it's made by David Fincher. That movie's twists work well because you think you know that kind of filmmaker's work. The Trouble with Harry, I think, does work well, and it's kind of a nice, funny, dark comedy because of the idea of, wow, these people are falling in love with each other while scheming how to hide a murder that they may have committed or may not have committed. It's a little bit hokey. The tone isn't exactly right. Shirley MacLaine is a lot of fun in her first film role. And all the four lead actors are pretty decent. But it doesn't have the kind of scope or ambition or the sinisterness that I think that Hitchcock brings to his very best work. It's a fun movie to see in part as part of an overall oeuvre, if you will, but it's not a movie where it's like, oh, if you haven't seen Trouble with Harry, then you haven't seen the best of Hitchcock. It's a perfectly fine one, but it's not great.
Yeah, it's a doodle. Like, it's a doodle. And you're exactly right about the idea that it is a, if this were a movie were not made by Alfred Hitchcock, A, it would be kind of forgettable, but B, you expect what you kind of know about him, particularly what people must have thought they knew about him at the time. Like, you can imagine people at the time being like, wait, what? because he was such a brand by this point. In fact, there are times it feels a little bit like an overlong version of one of those Alfred Hitchcock Presents things that he had in his TV show.
Right.
Like, it feels like a little bit of an idea, a little bit of a nudge that just kind of keeps going on for a while. I mean that to say, not to say that it's bad. There's a lot of little fun moments. There's a lot of little amusing ideas. I particularly like the line where, like, he just kind of dashes off that that he looked exactly the same when he was alive, except he was vertical. Just like a really nice little line. Like, there's a few there. John Forrest had this kind of light on his feet and really kind of fun. But there's not a lot. It does feel the B-side thing is pretty right. And I'm surprised. I would be curious to talk to the person that suggested this as the movie for us for the reboot. Because I have to say, while I was watching, I was like, this is pretty good. This is fun. I like this. This is in the total Hitchcock universe, I see where this kind of fits in. He's having fun here. He's kind of having a good time. But man, there's a whole bunch of other Alfred Hitchcock movies I wish I were watching.
Yeah, I mean, we are both big Woody Allen fans. And one of the things that we have to deal with a lot is when Woody Allen does one of his more minor works, the complaint is, why is he wasting his time doing this? He should be doing a Match Point or an Annie Hall or whatever. And for real fans of a filmmaker, you don't mind the doodle so much because it's revisiting themes in a different way or from a slightly different, like, slant or tone. And there are rewards in seeing, like, a filmmaker keep doing the same things over and over. But I did feel kind of the same way where, you know, also, because I think it is worth saying, his really great movies are still really great. They hold up really well. So it's not as if the world is kind of like going through the back catalog going, well, maybe there's some other ones that are actually good because these other ones don't hold up. They actually do hold up really well. I know this is based on a book, and I'm kind of curious what the book's tone is like, because I like how this movie, my favorite line in the entire Wikipedia plot description for this movie is, in any case, no one is upset at all about Harry's death. And that I think is the most Hitchcockian element of the movie, which is fun, was this idea of, like, yeah, what are we going to do about this corpse? And, you know, because you see its legs stick out a decent amount, the movie keeps tempting you to forget that it's a real person who's died. And then you keep going, oh, wait, this is actually a real person. And that, and the deceptive cheeriness of the movie is shot really, like, yeah, it's so tranquil and, like, idyllic. The setting and the music is really kind of, like, happy and cheery. It kind of, like, lulls you into a sense of, like, tee-hee-hee, isn't this sort of like a fun, like, farce, when actually there's a much darker thing going on. That would be a fun paper to write in a film school class. But sometimes watching it as a movie is not as satisfying as I kind of wished it was.
Yeah, it is. This, you bring up farce. I have in my notes, I kind of had here, this is as close as he'll kind of make to making a farce, except for the fact that, like, at his absolute best, there are farcical moments in some of his best movies, but they feel like the stakes are higher. Like, here, everyone is almost, I get that he's going for a vibe of kind of like that. I mean, to me, that's the joke of the movie, is that line they say in the Wikipedia, is that, like, no one seems really upset that there's a dead guy there, which is fine, but that is a very prevalent joke in this movie. And the fact that they have to keep digging him up and putting him back in the ground, again, clever, but it's kind of a repeated joke. And it's fine. It's Hitchcock, but it's just, it did. I feel like I have to repeat it. That is how I felt watching this. I'm like, okay, I get it. I'm glad I saw this. But man, I really would rather be watching Stranger on the Train right now. I'd rather be watching North by Northwest. We'll do Rear Window again. We've already done that on the podcast. I almost felt like that would be a fun one to do. Though I will say, I don't know how much more you want to go on this. I will say, though, I would love it if every movie ends in the exact same way that The Trouble with Harry ends. Because literally the last second... Yes. The last second of the movie, because the credits are at the beginning. So if you're watching this and you see that the clock start to tick down, 15, 14, 13, the movie's still going. Literally the last shot with 1 second left, like a jumper at the buzzer, it flashes, "The Trouble with Harry is over." And that's just the text on the line on the movie. The last thing you see. I would be okay with every movie saying, hey, Captain America Winter Soldier is over.
Yeah, I feel like the closest modern equivalent is the end of Deadpool when people stuck around for the end through the end credits and he pops his head out and goes, "Go home." Like that's as close as we get now. I will say what I like about the ending that also I think works for the movie in general is because you just see the corpse's feet. You do sort of think about what the guy looks like. I don't know if you did this, but I think there's actually something kind of clever about because you don't see his face, you keep thinking about that guy and who that person is. You see a drawing of him, and I think you maybe see his, I'm trying to think if you actually see his face at any point.
I don't think so.
Yeah, you see the drawing that John Forsyth does, and that's one of the things that almost gets them caught. But it is sort of a great thing where you, because you don't see that person, it does make you, in your mind, construct that person. You hear stories about Harry and who Harry was, and he doesn't sound like he was the greatest of guys, to be honest. But you do think about him. This thing that about kind of like energizing an unseen character in that way, which I think is kind of fun. But I forgot about the ending though, because it this is it. I have to say, just in general, I like end credits. There's a lot more credits now in movies than there were back in the 1950s, which is good for all the people who actually work on these movies. But there is something that's so greatly satisfying about quote-unquote older movies, where they just have all the credits at the end, and then when the movie, or I'm sorry, at the beginning, and then when the movie is over, that's it. It's just like,
you're done. You can
like,
leave now. Get out of here.
It's just like, I wonder what that must have been like, where it's like, the movie's over, hit the lights, we're done now. So, yeah.
Yes, and one final thing on this. You talked about this was the first movie for Shirley MacLaine. Let's not forget who plays Shirley MacLaine's son in this movie. It is Jerry Mathers. It is the Beaver. The Beaver is her son in this movie. So in case you were wondering, wow, I loved him on Leave It to Beaver, but I would like to see his earlier work. Here is your opportunity, because here is Jerry Mathers as the Beaver, except a little bit younger.
So that's something.
That is something. That is a thing. That is true. All right. So that is The Trouble with Harry. Thank you for the recommendation. I encourage anyone to give us reboots of other Alfred Hitchcock movies that we would rather watch. Nothing against The Trouble with Harry, which is perfectly fine. But I think I there are many Hitchcock movies that I would watch over and over and over again. This is not one of them.
I would agree.
They're clones. What a cheap trick.
It's clones, people. I saw that movie. I was at the premiere.
Get back. Get back.
There is no such thing as pod people, is there?
You're not my sister.
And you're not my sister.
Big Business came out in 1988. It is directed by Jim Abrahams in a very different movie than some of the other movies he has directed. Stars Bette Midler and Lily Tomlin, each playing two roles and each playing twins. Basically, what happens is in the 1940s or whatever year that they were born, who would I to me to tell two lovely women what year they were born? Whatever time it was, there's a very rich couple, a woman who's very pregnant, driving through rural West Virginia when she goes into labor, takes her to a local hospital. As it turns out, there is another very poor rural family also giving birth at the exact same time. They both have twins. One of the babies gets switched. And so it turns out that these two twins grow up in New York City and all the wealth of that. And the other two twins grow up in the rural West Virginia. And then flash forward, I'm not going to even say how many years, a certain number of years to the modern day of 1988. And they look a lot like Bette Midler and Lily Tomlin, and all sorts of wacky hijinks ensue. This is one of those touchstone comedies from around this time period that you may remember, where they always were very high concept. They always, I found myself, we'll get into the actual thoughts about the movie though, but I found myself nostalgic for a time where all you needed as an idea for a movie was really just to say, Bette Midler and Lily Tomlin are both really funny, so let's put them in a movie where they're really funny. And that was like enough. Like that was like enough to make the movie. I was trying to think of who the equivalent people in that movie today would be. And that movie would obviously never be made. It would have to be made like independently with like Jenny Slate. like it'd be very low. It'd be very, you know, very low budget. Anyway, so this movie is a farce. It's a big, wacky, broad farce. Each of the each of the, it's basically an excuse for each of these very, very, very talented comedic actresses to play big and to go large. It's funny, this movie I read on the Wikipedia was originally written for Barbara Streisand and Goldie Hawn. I think it is better than it would be with, better with Bette Midler and Lily Tomlin than it would be with that. This is not to say that it would have been good. And I think that I find myself, this movie feels so kind of dashed off and so kind of amped up and dialed up to a to this crazy farce level that I find myself at times having a lot of respect for the moments where the very talented and the talent of Tomlin and Midler can come out. I found myself enjoying those moments where like, oh, that's a funny little twist, particularly Lily Tomlin, who I think is great and has little moments that of like weirdness that kind of sneak in inside this very broad comedy. Ultimately, though, I mean, this is still a Three's Company plot where all it takes is just one person to say one thing or to open up one door at one time. I enjoy the fact that Chick Hearn, former Lakers announcer, has an odd cameo broadcasting an ESPN telecast of a mini golf tournament with a younger but still looking like to be 55 Fred Ward. But ultimately, there's only so far a movie like this can take me. I found myself enjoying the lead actresses in it and the effort they were putting in, but ultimately pretty tired by the end of it.
I love, by the way, that Chick Hearn, I don't think, is playing himself. I think he's credited as sports announcer. Mm-hmm. So it's not even Chick Hearn himself. It's just a sports announcer. Yeah, it's so... It's such a junky, goofy movie. My sister is not a big movie watcher, and one of the things when she asks me, like, do you think I would like such and such movie, she's given me a list of criteria of things that she doesn't like in movies. And it's kind of a long list, but one of the things is she doesn't like misunderstandings. Where like basically if somebody doesn't know something or if somebody just told somebody something, it would take care of it. That makes her really angry. Big Business would be the worst movie in my sister's life because it really is like the most amazingly choreographed elevator near misses in cinema history are contained in Big Business. Not till like prime Frasier episodes do we have this much like in American comedy, this much like, you know, misunderstanding and people just missing each other at the last second. I will say, I actually thought that some of the effects actually held up pretty well, sort of to my surprise. And I will say that if you're watching a Bette Midler, Lily Tomlin comedy to look at its effects, you're probably not enjoying the movie that much. I mean, it's silly. It's dumb. It is very much just like, hey, you know, as the poster's tagline about Two's Company's Four is a Riot is probably as far as the pitch ever went in terms of developing this. Yeah, I mean, Tomlin and Midler are really fun. I actually prefer Midler just because her two characters are so different that she gets to kind of play more different in her. I will confess that there were times I had to remember which Lily Tomlin character I was looking at.
Yeah, they actually give her a button to put on her chest just to make it clear that you can differentiate which one she is, which I think is also a bad sign.
That's the Jim Abrahams touch. That's right there. You know, of course, he's part of the Zucker Abrahams, you know, team. This is not that type of movie. Part of me kind of wished for more of that kind of lunacy in this movie. You know, I will say that as it kind of rolls along and the more kind of insane in terms of how preposterous it is, I did kind of get swept up a little bit in the preposterousness of it all. Of put it this way, this is the type of movie that does kind of tell its audience, like, look, this is what the movie is. Like, you're either going to go with that or not. And so to a certain extent, I was like, you know what? It would be more pleasurable if I chose to go with this as opposed to not liking it. And there is enough kind of like, there is some fun stuff. I am convinced that Fred Ward came out of the womb with a full head of hair. Like he seems impossible. The idea that he has ever been young. Seeing what's his face, Michael Gross, right from Family Ties. Yes. It's like fun. It's fun to see him in this. I was actually kind of pleasantly surprised that for a comedy in 1988, you actually have two gay characters, and the movie actually doesn't make it like, can you believe they're gay? Whoa!
Yeah, if anything, the weird, because the foil to that scene is that Fred Ward, who is from rural West Virginia, can't believe, like, if you guys are sleeping in the same bed, like, I'll sleep in the same bed, you can sleep on the couch. Like, the joke is kind of on him in a way that I was kind of impressed from 1988.
Yeah, so I mean, there is some, like, fun stuff, you know, again, because I can't help myself when a movie is just sort of mediocre like this. I start to think, okay, so this is like 1988. What's kind of going on in the world, or at least in America? And, you know, you do see this, I feel like, in certain kind of like comedies of the 80s, where it's like New York is looked at as this, like, whether it's Crocodile Dundee or this, like, did nobody actually travel to New York? And so they just made New York as like this fantastical slash scary slash amazing place, because once again, you're kind of visiting a comedy where New York is sort of the end all be all kind of thing. About getting to New York is like the biggest deal in the world. And that, just the fact that somebody is in New York is hilarious. So I kind of appreciated that.
They need to cook the sushi more, Grayson. They need to cook that sushi more.
Yeah. And I appreciate shoulder pad jokes as much as the next person. I do love that Lily Tomlin's shoulder pad and her outfit keeps falling down her sleeve. There's an amazing, like, brooch. Is that a brooch? Is that the correct terminology that one of them wears? I was like, you know, it's so 80s in terms of, like, what people are wearing. Those suits are all just garish and terrible that both the men and women wear in this movie. And, you know, I think Edward Herman is kind of fun. I kind of enjoyed him a little bit. But yeah, I'm trying to look at the bright side of a movie that I found not bad, but pretty forgettable even as I was watching it.
Yeah. And there's just a lot of, there's a couple of scenes I think are staged kind of fun. The scene where they finally meet is staged in kind of a funny way. It turns into slapstick and over the top, but I kind of like that there's a mirror here and they naturally, because they're twins and don't realize those movements, mirror each other's movements a little bit. I thought it was kind of a clever kind of way to do that. But of course, it devolves into everybody screaming. There's nothing, no better way to resolve a scene than to just have a scene where everybody screams. Everybody's screaming, Grierson.
It's always so much screaming. It's always funny. It's always funny when someone's screaming. Yeah, and Seth Green is in
Seth Green. Movie. Seth Green. Yes, yes. Post radio days, but before he turned into that Seth Green.
You were saying at the beginning about, like, you know, how would this movie be made now? I was sort of thinking that, like, that Amy Schumer Goldie Hawn comedy that's coming out this summer, like, that's probably the closest. Now, of course, they're not like twins or whatever, but like a mother daughter kind of thing.
Yeah, Amy Schumer, Jenny Slate. Amy Schumer, Jenny Slate. I think that would be who would do this movie now.
So if anybody's listening, we have a hot high concept remake idea.
I think I would like that movie at the time and find it insufferable in 25 years, which is probably the best way to think about it. Other than the fact that I like the fact in the list of names for faceless global corporations, Moramax is not a terrible name for one.
I actually like Moramax.
That's what I mean.
That's actually not terrible. I kind of like that. And then also, they had a good logo. I feel like they always, like, mess up the logos in these types of things. Their logo actually seemed like what Moramax would look like. So good job, production designer, I guess.
Yes, absolutely. And I will say, just like as a general rule, I have a happy notion about Lily Tomlin. I just like Lily Tomlin and pretty much everything. I don't know. Have you seen her Netflix series?
I have not.
Grace and Frankie with her and Jade Fine. It's very good. It's a good show, and she's very funny in it. So anytime that Lily Tomlin is doing anything, it makes me happy. I have no bad thoughts about Ben Midler, but I probably have more of a natural affinity for Lily Tomlin. I think it's fun to watch her do anything.
Yes. It's for me, it's impossible to see Bette Midler do anything without thinking of that Simpsons episode. Oh no, Bette Midler. Every time, both a Simpsons cameo and a Seinfeld cameo in the '90s. Yes.
All right. So that is Big Business. We got a good 12 minutes conversation on Big Business. That's a little bit more than I thought we were going to get. So thank you for that submission of Big Business. We always tell you we will get to every movie you give to us on our iTunes reviews and our reboot segments. Here is further proof. All right. So that was Big Business. Hey, check it out. Grierson talks like this now.
I do. We should have reviewed Big Business as a haiku.
We should have.
I now realize that.
In honor of Sut 83, we should have done that. And done it twice, because Sut 83 gave us Big Business twice review. So that was Big Business. Thank you, as always, for everyone who gives us our reboot movies. And that is our episode of Grierson Being Back. We are back to normal now. We are back to our regular schedule. Grierson is going to be talking all the time. Thanks again to Christy LeMaire and Mark Lasanti and Scott Duvall, by the way, for pretending to be Grierson at the beginning of this podcast. I hope at least a couple of you fell for that briefly. But Grierson, I have to say, it's just mostly great to have you back. And now we get back to our regular normal shows next week.
Yes, our normal lovely banter between
exactly, you and me. Exactly. Yes. Grierson, you and I love nothing more. As we discussed in our Repo Man review, you and I were outed as normals. We are normals. We are normals. We are no fun. We are not freaks. We're normal dorks. So now we get back to our regular schedule of being normal dorks.
Yes. I mean, maybe we'll be more Meatloaf references next week. Who knows?
You don't know anything about... See, you can't give me Meatloaf songs, man. Midnight at the Lost and Found. Okay, sorry. I'm going to stop now. I promise. Okay, so the next week we have the one big movie that will be released. We'll be discussing is Ghost in the Shell, directed by Rupert Sanders, starring Scarlett Johansson, Juliette Binoche, Michael Pitt, Takashi Kitano, and it is of course a remake of the much beloved and much less Scarlett and Johansson-y movie from years back. So we're going to discuss Ghost in the Shell next week. And then we have two reboot movies. The first reboot movie is The Last Picture Show. It came out in 1971, directed by Peter Bogdanovich, based off the Larry McMurtry story. Starring Timothy Bottoms, Jeff Bridges, Sybil Shepherd in her first movie, Ellen Burstyn, Cloris Leachman, and a pre-sex on live online video, Randy Quaid. Has to be mentioned every time you mentioned Randy Quaid.
You actually didn't have to mention that. I had actually forgotten about that.
Poor Randy Quaid, man. You know, because you know they're remaking what's the movie he did with Jack Nicholson? The Last Detail.
Yes, they are.
They're doing a sequel, I believe, actually, to The Last Detail. So, I'm assuming we'll know that's just what the character's doing now. He's having sex with his wife while she's wearing a Rupert Murdoch mask on live tweets. Anyway, all right. So, our second movie, really not all that different than the Randy Quaid videos that we've been discussing.
Is this another feature debut like Bogdanovich's? Is this auteur's first film?
It is. It is his first film, and it may, in fact, last even longer than Peter Bogdanovich's movie. Just as a little precursor before we talk about let us know what our next movie is going to be. Grierson and I have discussed, I'm sure we will get into this very much next week, how we tend to not like the whole, this movie's so bad, it's good, the Gymkhatas of the world, if you remember when we did Gymkhata. Those are not our favorite type of movies. Troll 2 or whatever those movies are. Generally speaking, our philosophy has always been, there are so many good movies in the world. As much as it may be fun, it may be enjoyable for everyone to have this collective experience, we tend to not want to spend our time purposely watching bad movies when there are so many great movies that we have not seen or many great movies we've not revisited in a long time. That's an accurate representation of your viewpoint on this, correct, Grierson?
That is a painfully accurate representation, yes. Life is too short. Watch something good.
Yes. So, well, that brings us to a movie that came to us from a reboot suggestion. And as soon as I saw it, because I feel this way, but Grierson really feels this way. And so I am very excited. I actually am excited because we are going to see next week 2003's The Room. We will be discussing Tommy Wiseau's The Room from 2003, of course, it's kind of, the Disaster Artist, I believe, is coming out. The movie written, directed by, and starring James Franco. I think it's screened at South by Southwest, as a matter of fact. It did, right? I got that right. It's screened, yes, there.
And got excellent reviews there. Yes. So, yes. So,
but the Room is something I have to say, I've not seen The Room all the way through, and I've certainly never gone to one of the late night screenings. A very good friend of mine, Lindsay Robertson, has been in 2003. She was one of those people that before it was screening said was always the one that wanted to go get stoned with everybody and watch The Room. So before it became a big thing, and I think I told her the exact same thing that Grierson and I just said, life is too short, I don't have time to see this movie, and this is just one of these dumb fad things that you and your comedy nerds are really into, and no one's going to think about this movie again. And here we are 14 years later, and The Room is still, like, literally if I type Room, the movie that won Brie Larson an Oscar, this comes up first. So keep that in mind. So Grierson and I are finally going to see The Room. I'm curious, Grierson, going in, because I feel like we're going to have a whole discussion this next week. Going in, are you excited to see it? Are you kind of annoyed that you have to see it? What's your general thoughts on finally when you go down and sit and watch The Room?
I am genuinely curious because I have never watched the movie. I have seen back when I used to go to the Sunset Five in Los Angeles. They would run this trailer over and over and over again before it became like The Room is terrible, let's laugh at it. And every time this trailer played, the audience would just die laughing, thinking, oh my God, what is this piece of garbage that they're going to be showing here at this theater? So that's all I have seen of that movie.
Let me get this straight. So, because that's the thing, right? Was So actually like paid for it to specifically play at that theater, correct?
I'll have to do my research, but later, yes, when it became like a cult thing and they'd run it like once a month.
I didn't think this was
before then.
That's what I'm saying. Is that like eventually it became a thing that like they were happy to do. But from what I understand, he paid them a bunch of money. I think that it was one of the theaters, because that's why that movie trailers. Because you went to the theater anyway. You were just going to see movies there, and then this was just this weird movie that they kept playing the trailer for over and over and over before anyone had any idea what it was. Correct? Is that what that's what you're saying?
Because the Sunset Five was an art house theater, and so you'd be going there for foreign language films or American independent films, and this trailer would come on in the middle of all these like normal trailers of that ilk, and people would just sort of be stunned. Like, I mean, I think they four-walled it, to use the term. I think Tommy Wiseau paid to have it shown there and had the trailer shown before most movies there, and people like me just thought, man, that movie, oh, it must not be good, like, you know, that kind of thing. And then
it became this.
I'll do my research before we do the podcast next week. But I am genuinely really, really curious. I've had the Netflix DVD for like a week. I am looking forward to the moment where I get to watch The Room.
All right, so next week we will be discussing Last Picture Show and The Room. I think we had a lot of movies to fit in on this podcast, so I think next week we're going to get into all three of those movies, maybe stick our teeth into them and figure out what in the world that's all about. Okay, Grierson, so welcome back, man. Welcome back. It's great to have you back.
Thank you. I'm very, very happy to be back.
Oh, damn time. And I have to say, I want listeners to listen. I hope you've listened very closely. I consider all of you ear, nose, and specifically throat experts. So if you hear anything more in Grierson's voice, remember, Grierson never smoked. All the scratches for me is because I used to smoke. Grierson never smoked. So if you hear anything more, I want you to be the first person to warn him and let him know about the nodule, because I don't want to have to go through this again.
Yes. And by the way, thanks for people who listen to this podcast and send me very nice emails and tweets about my recovery. I really, really appreciate it. But I'm hopefully all back to normal. And Will, if you ever want to see some of the pictures that they took during my surgery of the removal of the nodule, just let me know. Happy to send them to you.
I think I'm going to be all right. I think I'm going to be all right. But if anybody wants them, by all means, just send it out from your personal account, not the Grierson Leach account, if you could please.
Yes, without warning, I'll just blast that. I will not do that as a gift. My gift to humanity.
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay, so I don't know. Who knows what people are into? There's probably some weird fetish snuff nodule people out there.
As we've established on the show this week, there are chips aficionados, so who knows?
Which is worse, being a chips aficionado or a nodule fetishist? Yeah. That is really the question. All right, Grierson, go rest your voice. We got another show to do next week. Have a great week, everyone. Thank you for coming back. I'm very happy to have you back, Grierson. We'll be back next week. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Hanging around this joint.